I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. Welcome, Fadi.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where are you from initially?
I'm Lebanese. I was born in Beirut, but grew up in Jordan. My family is there, and my roots are mostly there.
How old were you when you moved to Jordan?
My father moved in the very early 60s, and we followed maybe two, three times. So I was about 3-4 years old.
What was the impetus for his moving to Jordan?
My father was in the airline business, but he was a political activist, and he was involved in a political party then in Lebanon that had tried to take over government. A familiar Middle East story. I'm sorry, there's the cliche there. And then eventually, because he was part of the leadership, he was sentenced to death.
You were so young at the time, but do you remember those days of being transported?
I have a vivid memory of us crossing the border by car and my sister crying. They didn't want us to leave. So we had a scuffle with my mother did with the customs people then, who ended up, because of my sister crying so much, ended up letting us go. So I have this this vision in my mind of us struggling at the border.
What did your father do in Jordan?
Well, my father comes from a relatively very poor family. My grandfather was a tram driver for the longest period of time, but he was a visionary in making sure that his 9 kids went to school. And my father was the eldest. So coming from such a background meant that you had to work harder. He left and came and studied here in NYU, by the way. He's an NYU grad from their aeronautics engineering school. He came here specifically to run away from politics. He had never seen an aircraft, and he chose aeronautics because he knew he didn't have to go to college locally because they didn't teach it, because he wanted to get away.
And did he take
a freshman, he took a ship, took him a month. And he spent 5 years here, worked. His first job was at American Airlines in Chicago. And then family pressure brought him back.
So your father makes his way back to the Middle East. Your father befriended the king and started Royal Jordanian Airlines.
Yeah.
How did he go from being a refugee to having this stature?
At that time, the politics of the region had King Hussein aligned with certain groups, and my father's group seemed to have been aligned with him at that time. Mm-hmm. And thus, when he ended up in Jordan as a political refugee, it was a natural connection. And thus, being an aeronautics engineer, and maybe one of the first 2 or 3 aeronautics engineer in the Arab world then, so what else was he going to do? And he had helped start an airline with a friend of his in Lebanon before that. So aeronautics engineer, entrepreneur, Jordan, small country, needed an airline. There you go.
Now, you were watching this as you were growing up. Did you have any ambitions to follow him in the airline business? Or what were your thoughts as far as a career was concerned?
You know, my memory is vague on this because maybe I didn't have any ambitions as such. I was a hyperactive kid. So my memory of myself was running around all the time, doing naughty and crazy things that scared the heck out of my mom. But I didn't think of what was I going to do in life, really. I didn't think long term. But I watched him. I watched him. I watched his political activism. He still is an incredible role model. The people he connected with were extremely interesting. So we lived a fascinating life, if you want.
And you went back to Lebanon to study at the American school there.
Yes. I'm surprised you got that. But in 1967, as you know, there was the Arab-Israeli war. We used to go to Beirut every summer for vacation out of Jordan. So, and that summer, June of 67, the war broke out. We were in Beirut vacationing. We didn't come back. So I ended up spending 3 years in boarding school in Beirut. I was actually It didn't work out for me in boarding school, so they basically kicked me out, and I went back to the family.
Well, you went to boarding school as a, you were 10 years old.
I was a baby.
Time. Right.
Oh, my God. I still say that to myself. Independent. Believe it or not, I used to get something called gate pass, a gate pass, which means it allows me to go out of school during weekends. And at 10 years old, I would take the bus and go to my grandparents' house, which is about a 45-minute, an hour drive. So I would go to the bus station, change buses. I still remember that and say, I would never let my kids even walk in the street nowadays. Mm-hmm. But I did that. It shaped part of my character.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 when Fadi was 22 years old, and Aramex was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. You ultimately made your way to the United States, to George Washington University,
yes,
for college. Yeah. What were your first impressions of the United States?
Well, I carried a heck of a lot of responsibility then because I came to the U.S. with my mom and my baby sister who had a learning disability. I was the only one driving then, so I had my sister went to a children's hospital, a special education program in D.C. So I had to basically wake up very early in the morning and drive her to school every single day for a full year while being a freshman and part of the swim team at GW. And my impression was the ease at 18 years. It's easy for a teenager to actually make his way around in the U.S. Most of the American students at that time were working to either support themselves or their tuition or their living. In the Middle East, unfortunately, that's unheard of. Our families provide for us until we get married and find a job. So that was fascinating for me. I was embarrassed sometimes to say that I didn't work. It was embarrassing. Your father pays for your tuition? Was like, wow. That was a standard question at that time. And it made me feel uncomfortable eventually, so I stopped talking about it.
You talk about the ease. Are you talking about even in the mundane life, like
ease,
the
like roads? Getting a driver's license. It took me nothing. You know, you did your eye exam and then you sit behind the computer and the driving test was cakewalk, easy.
So it's ironic you say that because we Americans do not think the DMV is easy. We think it's a logistical nightmare.
You guys need to see what happens in the rest of the world and to appreciate of what your DMV is. And then eventually renewal was via mail. That's unheard of anywhere in the world today.
It's the first time we've heard of the DMV being an example of efficiency.
Right. Well, life is, things are relative. So you need to see what happens somewhere else to appreciate what you have.
What about negative impressions of the United States when you were first here?
Negative impressions in my early days was the, and I'm sorry to say that, is the ignorance of world affairs and specifically of the Middle East. It was very frustrating for me, but fantastically, you know, probably if you want to ask me what was the single most important thing that I learned in the U.S. is how to understand the causes that I care for in the Middle East and know how to argue them in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I used to think that it was a natural. We used to think that we have a just cause, and just causes sell themselves. But the reality, nothing sells itself unless you're able to argue it and argue it well and know your facts very well. So from the early days, it was also my first exposure to Jews. It was my first exposure to an argument on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I basically had to understand democracy, understand argument, understand debate well, and knowing how to present yourself was such an essential. Again, coming from a political family, I automatically became a political activist here with the Arab Students Union. And there was, you know, at that time, it was so heated. And I looked a bit, you know, I had a big beard and my hair was long and I looked like a bit of a revolutionary.
Here you were in a very politicized, heated environment. What about your academic life? What did you focus on?
Oh, you know, I started, my first year was, I went into engineering school. And then I failed miserably. I had an F in a physics class. It didn't work out for me with engineering. I automatically changed into political science. I think it's also a very important step for me because in political science, I also got to understand the habit of reading. Mm. And that helped me a lot in my entrepreneurial life.
So you leave George Washington, you graduate, and you start Aramex out of college by accident. You met your co-founder, Bill Kingston,
yes,
in the United States.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, Bill knew my dad. So, and I stumbled into him. I think we were at the Paris Air Show. FedEx was just happening in the U.S. back then. He said, this is an interesting business. Maybe we should do something in the Middle East. Cool. Why not? I am ready. And then he arranged that I go to see the FedEx hub in Memphis. And there was a company called Purelator Courier then in the U.S. Most people don't remember it now, but it used to be bigger than FedEx, believe it or not. Obviously, these were massive for me. FedEx, aircrafts, Middle East does not fit into that. Went back to Amman to start the business.
Here you are doing all this research, going yes, from courier company to courier
right,
company in the United States.
Yes.
But you're a maverick. You seemed a little unreliable and heated.
Yeah.
Why?
I still am.
Why would Bill trust you to start this business in
Bill,
the Middle East?
Well, you know, it's not a question of trust. He was basically talking to my father, not to me. A logical man would never get into this business because it's a very, very difficult business to get into because you're effectively having to build a global network from day one. I mean, that's the nature of the beast.
Right. What were the first steps that you took to build Aramex?
Well, the first steps that we took is after I looked at the study that Bill had done, we threw it in the garbage, obviously, because it was done by an American company who tapped into research and information about the region, which still doesn't exist today. Forget about that. Threw that in the garbage. And we started researching how do you register a company. And at that time, post offices would not allow anybody to get in because they thought we were their competitors and this was a monopolistic situation for them. The law did not allow for courier companies. But DHL and ourselves were at the forefront of actually fighting for deregulation and allowing people like us to establish the mail delivery business. And then we also stumbled simultaneously onto the fact that a lot of the American companies then, FedEx, UPS, Burlington, Purelator, Airborne Express, gave their packages to deliver in the Middle East. They gave them to competitors like DHL and TNT at that time. So click to us. This is where the niche is. You establish an independent network in the region to deliver packages for these guys who are not interested to be in the Middle East at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai. We'll hear more from Fadi coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. So the way you got in the door was by being a supporter of the FedExes in the Middle East. And you weren't their competitor at the time. You were seen as a partner of theirs.
This was our selling point. We said, we're independent. We'll build a network for you. We will customize. Even the word customization was not there yet. But we actually delivered for every single competitor. Aramex was their single source of delivery. They all gave us their packages in the Middle East, so they had one address in the Middle East, even though they hated each other here. We were able to answer a phone for FedEx. We had an Airborne phone, and we had an Emery phone and a Purelator phone, and we delivered on their paperwork. The FedEx brand was there through me. So for them, it was a natural. They didn't have to do anything. We had an office here in New York, and all FedEx needed to do, or Airborne, was to deliver at our JFK office, which still exists today. And from there, we took it all the way. So they didn't have to think of customs, procedures, anything. Just give it to me there, and we'll take it. And eventually, we opened an office in New York, in Paris, London, and in Hong Kong and in Singapore to do exactly the same thing for other courier companies in other parts of the world, so that nobody had to think about shipping into the Middle East because it was a bit complicated. Where's the Middle East? We didn't know. The geography was not even known then.
So you were this—you were the wholesaler and you were the courier to these couriers.
Absolutely. We were the courier of couriers, if you want, to the Middle East. So we were a known brand to the industry.
Did you know you wanted to branch out on your own after servicing FedEx and these other couriers, learning on their dime?
Yes.
At what point did you say, you know what, I want to eventually compete with these guys?
Yeah, well, I would have loved to stay doing their stuff because it was easy stuff. I didn't have to have retail operations or anything. But the reality of the matter is we knew that they will eventually go global. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Europe. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Asia. So the minute they say they're global, they it means the Middle East. So they can do it two ways in the Middle East, either acquire us or go set up their own operation. We've had some discussions with some of them about acquisitions, but we never came to a conclusion, luckily, because the value of the company today and every day that we refused any offer increased.
What was the delta between FedEx and Airborne Express's perception of you as a reliable company in the Middle East to do their work and the reality of what you were? Like, what level of improvisation had to happen?
Oh, plenty of improvisation. So we built the business on the backs of our clients. Meaning, you know, I learned the business from Federal Express and Airborne Express. I mean, I understood my limitations very well, and I understood their power so well. And I took advantage of it to the hilt. Meaning, every time I had the chance to meet, learn, send people from my company to get trained by these guys, we did. And we did that by pushing them very hard to take our kids to get trained by them. And that's how we learned the business. I know everything that I need to know about this industry today because of FedEx and Airborne Express. They taught us the business and they paid us for it. Mm. The other thing that you need to know is their ignorance in the early days of the region, and I can say that now, led me to do things that they didn't know. Meaning, I would have claimed that I had a full network. That was not a lie, but that was not the full truth either. So, meaning I always had somebody somewhere to deliver a package for me, but it didn't mean it was my employee. I always found someone, a taxi driver here or a travel agent there, and I would say, you know, call him and say, here's an airway bill coming to you on this airline. Please go to customs and clear it and deliver it. And say you're from Aramex. Because the reality of the matter is, as all startups are, and especially in the Middle East, we were undercapitalized. We were not sure we were going to make it. And so you needed to improvise. I was regularly taking a flight from Amman, our hub then, to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and have packages with me.
You were the delivery boy.
I was the delivery boy. I would check into a hotel, literally check into a hotel, wake up very early next morning, grab a cab, tell him I have these 10 addresses. I would go and deliver every package to these people and go back in the afternoon and do my business meetings so that I can try to get my license. So, but nobody knew that then. Mm-hmm. Nobody. I would knock on these doors and say, I have this package. But I was the founder of this company delivering those packages. And that's how I learned the business.
This was in the early 1980s. If I had told you then that you would be a billion-dollar company in 2010, would you have been surprised? Or
I would have been absolutely surprised. Our market cap when we were public on NASDAQ in 1997 never exceeded $70 million. Yeah, small micro cap. $1 billion, my God, you know, at the height of this company, when we went public on the Dubai Stock Exchange, we actually hit $2 billion. And so, wow. I mean, this is incredible for us.
You mentioned FedEx. The founder of FedEx is Fred Smith.
Yes.
Did you meet him?
I met Fred Smith, and I know exactly how I met him. So I went to every single conference on the industry that could happen during those days. I was still in my 20s. So Fred Smith was a keynote speaker at one of those conferences. And I said, I have to meet this man. So right before he finished, I waited at the door. And I'm a shy man in general. And before people attacked, I came to him and said, you know, I am so-and-so, and I have this small company. And then he was nice. He said, yes, nice to meet you. And from then on, I kept following him, believe it or not. Wherever he was a keynote speaker, I would follow Fred Smith, and I would continue to go back and introduce myself and say, remember me? I came to see you once. He's without him doing it directly, he was a mentor.
Now, FedEx is one of the world's largest airlines.
Right.
At what point did you start to build an airline business behind Aramex?
We were never an airline. We're still not an airline. We are a non-asset-based company, and we have taken a decision very early on to be a non-asset-based company. One, because we didn't have the capital. Number two, because we knew it can be done without necessarily building an airline or building assets. It is about the customer experience, and that's where we focused.
Do you think if you had more access to capital in the Middle East that you might be a different company? Because if capital had been easier for you, you might have started an airline and been an asset-rich company.
Right, and luckily not. And that's one thing that I would never, if you tell me what would you do differently, I would tell you I would certainly not look for more capital, because the biggest learning experience for us is having to do things on the very cheap, and that created an incredible amount of innovation and creativity inside the organization. We conserved. We were entrepreneurs on one side, but we understood the value of the dollar, and that is what makes us successful today.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Was there ever a turning point in the company? I mean, here you were really just scotch taping things together and improvising your way through building this company. At what point did you say, wow, you know what, we're becoming an institution?
Well, I think by the time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, in 1990, we had reached a point of having relative stability in the network in the Middle East. Nothing fantastic, nothing fancy, but we had a nice brand with the industry. And then the war comes, and then all hell breaks loose. Kuwait is invaded and occupied. Saudi Arabia airspace was closed. 500,000 American troops on Saudi soil. Airspace in Jordan was closed. We were shut down. And then we had to respond to that crisis internally in the company and manage resources. We had employees in Kuwait then that we came driving to Jordan. FedEx withdrew then. They had some offices in the region, by the way, and said, we're shutting down. You deliver everything for us. So we felt a sense of responsibility, and we felt that even with that crisis, we didn't lay off any people then still, if you want, and we were able to scrap and manage and make sure that the company was intact, even though it was an existential issue. But we thought in crisis, when we responded and we responded together, we said, this is a company that is here to stay. As the war ended, clients appreciated this massively. And from there on, we were the company that has stayed. A lot of banks relied on us at that time. Even, you know, I remember the CEO of the Arab Bank, which is one of the largest banks, the largest bank in Jordan, calling me in the middle of the war and telling me, Fadi, we have these magnetic tapes that we need to secure, and I need them out of this country, and I need you to every single day take these magnetic tapes and take them to a country that is more secure. That was a turning point for us, and that was a turning point for our brand in the region. And from there on, we started building the business from the grassroots up.
By the way, you were married to your business. You were growing the company. What was going on in your personal life at the time?
I was married to the business, and I was married to Rula, who is my wife. We're separated now, but she's still my wife and still a very good friend of mine. And the mother of my two sons. It's a strain on family life.
You're on a plane more than 50% of your time. Do you find that enervating or energizing?
I unfortunately am. How shall I put that? I am an addict of traveling now. Which is crazy, because I feel if I spend more than a week in one place, I am stuck. And one thing I didn't want to do, like my father, was to have that constant travel. But I guess that's one habit I inherited from him. And I'm a curious person. I became much more curious as I grow and realize how little I know, and my drive to knowledge is insatiable. So I am constantly traveling. I'm constantly meeting people. I'm constantly doing things. I mean, that's my life today, and I wouldn't have any other way. I love it. I absolutely love it.
You seem to have a lot of energy. You swim every day, or you try to.
Yeah, That's something I will never compromise on. I've been swimming since as long as I remember.
What does it do for you?
It's the ultimate meditation. So people talk about, you know, yoga and breathing exercises. Swimming is the ultimate breathing exercise, because that's all you're doing. And it just clears my mind. It gives me the energy to go on. I'm disciplined in that. I'm disciplined in my food. I'm disciplined in my work. I'm disciplined in my exercise. Even though I am rebellious and here and there. But when it comes to something which I feel is a responsibility towards myself, towards my family, towards what I do, I am extremely disciplined. I have this sense of responsibility which drives me crazy sometimes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. In 1997, you decided to go public on an American stock exchange, the NASDAQ. What was the impetus for that?
We ended up wanting to do a private placement in the region to raise money from Arab capital, if you want. But we failed. We failed miserably because we were a non-asset-based company. At that time, people would ask me, do you own buildings? Do you own aircrafts? What do you own? I said, you know, I don't own anything. We own the client experience. I'm in the package delivery business. I do it well. That's all I own. I have a network. I have strategic alliances. No, we don't own anything. We barely own our cars. So for them, you know, why would you want to value? At that time, I think we were valuing the company at around $30 or $35 million in a private placement. So where's the value then? So we failed. So Bill looks at me and says, you know what, Fadi? We're going to go to NASDAQ. And that scared the heck out of me. I said, Bill, what do you mean NASDAQ? NASDAQ, this company is owned by me and you. Mm-hmm. Nobody looks at our numbers. We barely audit our numbers. We audit them, but we barely audit them. Legally, we're like 500 different companies. There's no one structure. He said, it can be done. That was August 1996. And luckily, Bill, his biggest gift to us, he also convinced Airborne Express around the same time to give us $2 million for 9% of the company. Mm. For the first time, after talking to Airborne for 13 years, they said, okay, here's $2 million. So the biggest check I had ever seen in my life kept me sleeping for quite some time, because I had, you know, life for an entrepreneur was managing cash flow. Other than making sure packages get delivered, I needed to every morning spend 2 hours with my chief financial officer juggling our payments, because we had such a terrible reputation for being such late payers. But that's life when you're scrapping to run a business. In any case, so Airborne buys 9% for $2 million. And then we say NASDAQ. All by January of 1997, we were on the exchange. So that was miraculous. I can't tell you. And I did the roadshow with Bill. We were only raising $7 million, believe it or not. This was a micro. 2 million of those went to the lawyers and to the banks. We were left with $5 million. And that was the first check that I ever took myself personally as an owner from the Green Shoe. Mm-hmm. So there was, you know, an oversubscription, and we ended up making, I don't know, $300,000-$400,000 extra. If you tell me what was the turning point, yes, originally what happened in the Iraq war, Iraq-Kuwait war, the reality of the matter, the biggest turning point in our life was us going on NASDAQ, because that made us a legitimate global brand in the eyes of our clients in the Middle East. Nobody had ever done it before. And the respect we got from banks, from clients, from people walking down the street who had heard about this story, until today, we're still called as Aramex, the company that was the first to go public on NASDAQ. It is a stamp on our forehead, and we're proud of it. It's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, especially because you have achieved such success in such an unlikely region. What needs to change?
I'll tell you what needs to change. It needs to have a government system that has a loose safety net. In the Gulf, where there's oil money, there's a huge safety net. The citizen does not feel the urge to innovate or to create or to create his own business, because our education system starts from day one telling us that the government is going to take care of us. We are not taught the skills that entrepreneurs need to be taught. We are not told that private enterprise is legitimate. Even though the Prophet Muhammad was an entrepreneur, and he was a traveler in trade, which means he had to deal with people, and his the owner of the business was a woman, his eventual future wife. We don't teach our kids because the state is predominant in our life. So we need to change our education system. We need to legitimize and say that entrepreneurship, private enterprise, not working for government is okay, is actually good for you. Having venture capital, angel investors bet on ideas and not bet on hard assets. We love building buildings, but I don't see as many people believing in ideas and believing in entrepreneurs and thus believing in people. But it's not as arid as people think it is. The Arab world is changing very quickly. There is a huge reservoir of entrepreneurs. I'm an angel investor, as you know. I can't tell you the amount of people that come to me on a daily basis asking, showing me their business plans and asking me for either help or advice or capital.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Coming up, we'll meet Andrew Goldsworthy, a leading sculptor who uses outdoor materials like wood, stone, and leaves. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the sculptor Andy Goldsworthy. Andy's sculptures are made out of wood, stone, ice, leaves, water, and mud, and can last anywhere from a few seconds to hundreds of years. Andy lives in Scotland, but his work has been exhibited widely in the United States, including at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, Stanford and Princeton Universities, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in California. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You spend so much of your time working outdoors, and I'm wondering what your relationship with the outdoors was when you were growing up.
As a kid? Oh, well, I had a regular sort of time as a child. You know, I played in woods and on the beach. I don't remember making many sculptures as a kid, but art was always very important to me. That was the only thing I could do. That's the only thing I was made for, was to make art. It was the driving passion through all my education.
Were your parents artists?
No, my mother looked after us kids, and my father was a university professor of mathematics.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the outskirts of Leeds, which is a big city in the north of England. On one side was the city, and on the other side were the fields, the green belt, as they called it. So it's this really interesting edge between the two, and I think that probably had a big effect on the way I see things. Walking through the new suburbs, I always remembered where the trees were, where the swamps were, and I could, you know, it's just underneath this veneer of tarmac and building, the swamps and the trees were still there somehow. And I think that definitely informs how I look at the urban spaces now. It's like trying to get through the surface appearance of things to what is the, you know, the nature of an urban place.
When did it first occur to you that you wanted to have a career in this type of sculpture?
Well, I think career is probably the wrong word to use for an artist. You make art, and if a career happens through that, then great. But when you sign up for art, you could be signing up for working as a part-time gardener or whatever, just to support your work and have a very frugal life in terms of material things. But obviously have a fantastic life in terms of what you gain through what you make. I am very, very fortunate to be able to have both, you know, that I can make a living from my work.
But you haven't always had both.
Absolutely not, no. When I was a student, I lived off very little. And when I left college, I lived off very little too. And for the first 8 years, it was like that. And I worked as a part-time gardener and other things.
You also worked on a farm. How did farming inform your work at all?
That was very important. Farming is a very sculptural activity. You know, the way haystacks are made, the ploughing of a field. And it's also at times a very brutal experience being on a farm. There's the death of animals, the rawness of working with the land, the weather, the harshness of it, as well as an intense beauty. It was a very powerful experience. When you're picking potatoes all day long or picking wild oats from a field of oats, stacking bales, you do these long, repetitive tasks. And you build up a certain working rhythm, and that helps enormously when I'm making sculptures.
It implies a sense of patience, in a way, to be able to do the same thing and tolerate that over and over again. Do you feel intellectually stimulated by picking potatoes or doing your sculptures?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't consider myself to be incredibly patient. I'm very determined. Patience is something to do with knitting. It's like it's too intense to describe it in that way. The unpredictability and very tedious and repetitive.
Where does this come from? Were you always, as a child, a hardworking, intense individual?
Well, I wasn't considered particularly gifted academically. And I did pretty badly in a lot of the subjects at school, except for art. I'd have always done out with a certain obsessiveness, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you made money from your art?
Yeah, I was shortly after I left art school. At that time, the Arts Council of Britain used to buy art and make an exhibition every year, and it was a great honour for the purchaser that year was Dr. Andrew Causey, who was at Manchester University, and he bought some early photographs of mine, and I'll never forget it because he had to talk me up to £30.
What do your photographs go for these days?
Do you know, I have no idea. I imagine a few $1,000s, but not huge. I mean, this is a really stupid kind of thing. I mean you, how many people have you interviewed that have just said what I've just said? I mean, obviously, I do care. I'm sure there's some, I have files somewhere that will tell me exactly how much they paid.
I want to talk about the themes in your art. One theme that's recurring is the sense of time. How did the sense of time come into play, or how does the sense of time come into play with your work for some listeners who aren't aware of your work?
Well, when I first began working outside, one of the very earliest works that I made outside on the beach was made in many ways as a reaction to the static studio that I was supposed to be working in as a student. Which I found incredibly difficult to work with. It's this place that didn't change, typically a white cube that students are given to work in. So you were met with these very contrasting images and experiences. You know, the college was very confined, very closed, very controlled, and this beach, which was different every day. And one day I just went out and made a couple of things on the beach, and the tide came in and washed them away, and I suddenly realized that I wasn't in control and time was dictating what I should make, how I could make it. And many of the earlier works were made for the moment in which they were made. And then later on, I began to realize that moment is the way it is because of what has happened before. And then time became even more important. I mean, then I began to think of the future too. For instance, making a stone cairn on the beach, waiting for the tide to come in and engulf it.
You talk about a stone cairn, C-A-I-R-N.
Mm-hmm. Although my cairns don't look like any other cairn that's ever been made, my cairns are often, they look more like a pine cone. I like to call them cairns because I like this association to marking a moment, a place, a journey.
To me, they look like eggs and they have that fragility sometimes when they are part of the beach and they might be torn down by the tides.
I do not see stone as something static or dead. I try to see it as something alive and living.
What do you mean by there is an inner life in stone?
Well, I don't mean in some slight kind of hippie sort of ya-ya way. You look at the granite of Manhattan, you know, that's a fire-formed material. You know, when you go into Central Park and you see where it's exposed and revealed, there's a certain flow and movement and a sense of change about that, even though it is solid. You know, I've actually made sculptures where I've fired stones, taken solid stones and fired them in a kiln and seen them turn liquid. Very violent, but it's very, very powerful to see this stone tearing apart.
Did the kiln break?
My father-in-law at the time, he was a potter, and I borrowed his kiln in the early days. And yes, one of the I wrecked a kiln.
By the way, when you would go home during school to work on the beach, what did your teachers think of that? Was there any controversy surrounding that?
It was a little difficult for the tutors. I was rejected from three art colleges before I got in one at the end. I had more or less given up going to art school. I was going to go and be an artist. I was going the direct route. I wasn't going to bother with this. So, but my father, being in universities, rang round and found a place. He drove me for my interview, and I was the last but one person to be accepted at Lancaster Art College. Now, all those rejections were really, really kind of a bit of a shock, but they change you dramatically. And through that process of rejection, I became very, very independently minded.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the sculptural artist Andy Goldsworthy. Are most of your innovations by accident?
Intuition is incredibly important. And the ephemeral work made outside for the moment, for the day, is made in the spirit of experimentation. I make an awful lot of bad work. There are things that go wrong. You know, things go wrong, can fail. It's important that they do fail. And that is the food. That's the lifeblood of my work. And it is driven by intuition.
Your work and in the early days, ability to live so frugally implies a rich spiritual life. What religion are you?
None. I was brought up a Methodist. My father's mother and father were Methodist, but I'm not religious. What I do has a spiritual content to it. I mean, the feeling for place, understanding of a place and my place and my relationship to the people who've been there before me, the people who will come after me. I just recently did a work for the Yorkshire Sculpture Park containing a large flat-bedded rock. I lay down on the rock. It began to snow. I got up and left a shadow. And that stone has been laid on there as an invitation for others to lay on the rock and leave their shadow. And I like this sense of the stone becoming ingrained with the memory of the people who've laid upon it.
What about the physical toll that your work has on you? I'm trying to look at your hands. Can I see your hands? You haven't had a manicure in a while.
No, I've never had a manicure in my life.
Let me see them again. Put them on the table.
Well, that one, that kind of squash finger there is from working on the farm where I dropped the back of a trailer on it. I got one knuckle missing here from banging that. I got a good one here from a piece of slate. We were doing a test, testing out the material for the National Gallery piece in Washington. I went to the quarries and that slipped me up there. But I mean, generally, they're not in bad condition considering what I do.
You have a few books of your work, and one of your books is called Time. You talk about how you need the resistance of weather to help you work more. You like in the early afternoon when the day is the hottest, that's when you work best.
Well, actually, that sentence came out of initially, I hate the heat. I really dislike the heat. I'm much happier in a cold place. Heat is a problem for me. I get very hot. I don't know how to deal with it. And this was in the south of France. What I did was that I started working in the river. I actually sat in the river and made works, which was obviously cooler. So I started working in the river with these colored stones, making lines that gradated from gray to white to yellow to red. And I began painting with stones. And underneath the effects of the water made the stones disappear, but the color rise out. So I turned the stone to liquid color in the river. And that was best at the middle of the day when the sun was at its hottest, because the sun was high and cast no shadow. So I turned what had originally been the most difficult time of the day in which for me to work to a sculpture that needed to be made at that time. That was a fantastic moment. And up till then, in hot places, I generally start getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, working, retreating in the middle of the day, and then coming out at night again. And somehow I always feel that's not dealing with the place properly, you know? So I do feel that if I can deal with it head on at its most difficult and make a great work, that is how it should be.
So there's that physical challenge for you.
Oh, I need that. When I'm in a gallery or doing installations inside, I can only work for so long before the energy begins to drain out.
I want to talk about this sense of reversing nature. And what I'm thinking of is you're bringing these giant snowballs into the middle of London on a summer day. What inspires you to do that sort of thing?
The snowballs were left on the streets of London on Midsummer's Day. We put them out on the streets in the middle of the night, so nobody knew how they got there.
What were people's reactions?
Well, there was a disbelief that it was snow, and then I actually held a press conference that morning. I knew I would be fighting for the life of the snowball, so to speak, and that they could have lasted 10 minutes. People could have just attacked them, and some of them lasted for 3 or 4 days. Most of them survived for a lot longer than I thought they would.
You have an important sense of place in your work. You did an exhibit at the Met, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, where you imported 30 rocks from Scotland to the rooftop of the Met. How come you just didn't use 30 rocks that you found, let's say, in Central Park?
There are occasions where, generally speaking, I like to work with the material that I find in a place. That's interesting. Also important to me is not just the rocks that I find, but movement and journeys and materials and also people take. And this journey from Europe to America is one that I do a lot, but it's got a long history to it, especially from Scotland. And granite bowls, it's Scottish granite, but there's, granite below you in the park. So I wanted to make that connection.
I want to talk about your personal life for a moment. You are divorced.
I am divorced, yeah.
How many children do you have?
I've got 4 kids.
What impact does the work have on your personal life?
Well, it is my personal life. It has no boundaries as the making of art. I mean, it encroaches or enriches, depends how you look on it, on everything that I do.
You're married to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you source your inspiration?
When I went to Bradford Art School, there was a lot of performance and happenings works. People out there on the streets doing works, unpredictable things, which really informed me an awful lot. This idea of art being out of the studio in real places, and the unpredictability of that. And nature has always been. And nature is not for me this kind of pastoral idyll that it's often perceived to be. The subject of nature is something that is supposed to be quaint and pretty. I mean, nature for me has always been very raw and harsh and brutal and beautiful too. Mm. It's been the most difficult subject matter, not the easy option that people like to think of it sometimes.
You are also inspired by graves at St. Patrick's Church somewhere in England. Didn't you take pieces of ice from the graves?
On occasion, I did. Yeah, but they would freeze over, and every so often, I'd try and lift an entire human shadow, you know, this kind of shape up. The shape of that informed a work nearby when I was where I was asked to do it was a private commission. I built three human-sized chambers for people to step into on top of this very bleak moor. The more people who step into this chamber, the more ingrained it will become with the memory of the people who stepped in there. And it is a place that's personally very important to me. But from that place, I could see the Morecambe Bay where I made my very first works. I could see the Morecambe where I was a student. I could see the church at Caton where I got married, because my ex-wife's village was there. I could see another couple of villages that I'd lived in. So there were all these places that I'd been in, had a relationship with, but was no longer there. And it was this sense that even though I'm not there, I still am connected to those places, that I've left a presence there.
How do you think you'll be entombed? You know, we're talking about graves, and there's a picture of you in one of your books throwing sand up in the air and just seeing wherever it would land, and it reminds me of cremated ashes. I'm wondering if you've ever thought about that for yourself.
Well, I have my father's ashes, which I'm going to make a throw from those at some point. But at the moment, it's in my will that I be buried next to the cairn that I made outside of Penpont, the village where I live. And this work was made in response. The village asked me to make a millennium sculpture, and it stands there as a guardian to the village. So I would like to be buried next to that.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me.
My guest has been Andrew Goldsworthy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.